My name is June Parsons. I'm an author. I've been working with First Course Technology. I was one of the first authors they signed when they started their business back in, 1992, I think. And then I proceeded with the company, you know, through the migration through Thompson Learning and now to Cengage. So currently I'm an author with Cengage, and my co-author, Dan Oja, is also here today. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about digital books. Dan and I have been working on digital textbooks since 1994. Our first fully interactive digital textbook was published in late 1994. It may be one of the first interactive digital textbooks ever published. So we've been in on the action for quite a while. So today, what I want to talk about is digital books in particular, but I'm also going to talk a bit about the whole kind of book marketplace currently, because digital is a part of the evolving textbook business. So let's look at the first slide. The U.S. textbook market is a huge business, $14 billion this past year. The college textbook market is $5 billion. And there are 21.8 million college students. You know, you just think, oh, if everyone buys one book, spends $1 on one book, good Lord. That sounds good to me. 9.5 million textbooks were sold in 2012. That was the most recent figure I could find. So obviously this is a market that looks really juicy. And so there are a lot of disruptors who are taking aim at this market. And the digital is one of those disruptors, but it's not the only one. You know, people are asking, is this a textbook bubble? Let's see. These figures are percentages. So in the past 2 years, we've seen an increase in the percent of students who have purchased at least one digital textbook. All right? You can see the, you know, we've gone from like 20% of students to almost 40% of students have purchased something in digital format for their courses. Overall, ebook sales got off to a really slow start in 2009. You can see they you know, took off. Kind of this, the hockey stick thing happened here in 2010 to 2011. And now we see a gradual increase. And we're kind of thinking that this is going to keep on going for a ways, and then it's going to sort of level off. So the rate of increase is reduced, but it is still increasing. The number of students, the percent of students who are purchasing ebooks. But, you know, we still get this kind of conflicting information. You think that all these millennials are just going to flock to ebooks. They've got their tablets, they got their laptops, and what? We'll just, you know, purchase digital, but forget print. But here, interesting, latest statistics show that 6 out of 10 students still prefer print books. Now, why would that be? You know, well, they're used to print books, but also there's the used book market, and this factors into students' decisions because students are very mercenary. You know, they're looking at the bottom line, and they see that with a print book they can buy the book, they can sell it back to the bookstore, and pay, you know, when all is said and done, maybe $30 for that book. Sean provided me with a few slides just earlier today, and so I quickly stuck them in. I didn't have time to revise the slide and out of copyright, as they say, make them my own. So I apologize for that. These are from the Nielsen PubTrack Higher Ed slide share, And this source of information is a really great source. And I think that Sean maybe is going to work with TAA, and we'll see if we can, you know, get that available for TAA members. It'd be really useful for us. That has all kinds of information on higher ed, which publishers are doing what, how much they're making, which schools are buying which textbooks. Oh, yeah. That's really, really valuable information for a staff. Anyway, back to this. Pricing of digital. You know, what does your publisher tell you about digital sales? There's this very interesting sort of pricing model going on. What they're saying is that we're going to sell those digital books for half the price of the retail book. But don't worry about your royalties, because we're going to sell twice as many, because students are not going to be buying and selling used books, because the digital book is on a subscription model. So every student needs to, this is the theory, subscribe to that book, the required book for the semester. Well, be that as it may, we'll see how that works out in the wash. The pricing of digital textbooks has continued to climb along with regular textbooks. So up from $56 in 2011 to $61 this past year. This other figure, though, is really interesting, too. This is the average textbook price, not the digital textbook price. And you can see that that price is $64, but this is an average of new and used books. So for us, I don't know, I can't really quite get my mind around the math here, because we only get royalties from the new book sales. We're not getting the royalties from the used book sales. So although these figures look the same, you know, very similar, I'm not sure how that translates to royalties for us in terms of what we're getting from our share of the print books and from our share of the digital books. So you can think about that yourself.
For the digital books,
yeah.
I assume the students download it to their computer.
Yes. Actually, typically they don't. Typically, it's an online product, so what they're doing is they're accessing it online. So they usually have a login of some sort.
And then does the book expire?
Then their access expires after a certain time. And most publishers have varying models, so you can rent a book for 90 days or 180 days or a year. And you know what most students do then. The shortest rental period. There are some books that you can download to a device, like a tablet computer, for use offline, although that is a rarer situation. It's not quite as popular, because the digital rights management is a little more difficult under those circumstances.
I choose to give open book exams. I find that it produces less stress from students, and my only rule is that you can bring a textbook, you can bring any notes, you can't use any electronic gizmo. And, of course, the reason for that is I don't want them to be searching mm-hmm. on the internet for things. Mm-hmm. I want them to know where to find them, because that's part of what we're hoping for. So I love the idea of moving to e-books, except for that one little wrinkle that then I've got to let them bring their electronic gizmos in a class if I want to keep to the open book thing. I'm guessing I'm not alone with this, and I wonder to what extent the industry is thinking about that. Is there a way of producing a licensing where that's unique? I have no idea how
I'm going to
finish
that. I haven't heard of anything like that. I don't know that the industry is thinking about that. My guess would be that the industry would, if they started to think about it, would think open book is basically open season. So not only can you look in the book, but you could look anywhere online. But that's an interesting idea that I think some publishers may want to hear about. So just a quick look at students themselves, like what devices do they have? And I think, as we expect, right, the percent of students who have laptop computers has grown over the past 10 years until now just about all students have a laptop. Desktop computers, you know, tanking. Other thing is smartphones. Almost all students now have smartphones. Just 80-some percent of them have a smartphone. Yeah.
What group of students are we talking about here?
We're talking about college students, undergraduates.
Well, probably a four-year university, because I did the same thing in a community college, and it doesn't match those numbers.
Ah, interesting. Lower, right?
Well, yeah, significantly lower.
Uh-huh.
Significantly lower. Most of them don't have laptop.
Yeah.
A higher percentage of smartphone, but it doesn't get as high as because it's that cost involved.
Yeah, that's what I would expect. Because in international markets, for example, the smartphone penetration is growing, and this is even in emerging countries, but the laptops are not, you know, not nearly as high. So if there's one device that people have, that students have, it's typically a smartphone.
Now, on that also, because I was doing use of smartphone in the classroom, I look at what is your plan, and they may have a smartphone, but they don't have an internet plan to go with that smartphone. So the ownership of one doesn't mean they can use the other, because you know, they use it just to call their family and friends or for emergencies, but then necessarily to have internet access. Now, if you have a wireless network in this
typically they could find a Wi-Fi connection. Well, some places they could and use it. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's kind of interesting about this is that the e-reader penetration is increasing, but it still looks very, very low. So this is Kindles and Nook readers, that kind of thing, very low. And tablet computers, we see, you know, here's the hockey stick again, whoosh, this thing goes up. But the projections are is that this is not going to continue, that this trend is going to level out pretty quickly right about here. For college students do realize that this is not a technology that they can typically use to do all their work.
I would just love to see a graph that showed for a particular student, like how many students have maybe all of those devices, and how many students have one device, because if you're an affluent and can afford it, you have a tablet and a laptop and a smartphone.
Sure, and an e-reader. They may have all those things. Yeah. In fact, I think I saw some statistics on that, but I don't remember all the details. But just in the back of my mind, it seems like most students had more than one of these devices. Now, I'm thinking probably it was a laptop and a smartphone. Yeah.
I just
want to
interject. We are recording this session, and I know it can be disruptive, you know, if you're like wanting to be spontaneous, but we won't capture your, you know, your great responses.
Okay.
All right,
we will. And just to give you a quick overview of the kinds of the operating systems that are available on these devices that students are using, you can see that on laptops, there's primarily Windows, as you might expect. On smartphones, iOS is very popular, but look at the Android. Yeah, wow. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to see the Android increasing. Tablet computers, iPads are very, very popular, still more popular than the Android devices. And in e-readers, Kindle has kind of cornered the market, and that will be increasing, we think. Now, what about digital formats? There are a lot of digital formats floating around there. Most publishers have a digital platform that they've developed. Cengage, for example, has the MindTap platform. Pearson has MyLabs and several others. Now, when we look at platforms, there are several characteristics that we need to consider. And the first thing is it a fixed layout or a flowing platform? Now, what is that? What's the difference? Fixed layout is a layout where you can have columns, you can have callouts, you can have marginalia. So this bottom row gives you some examples of fixed layout books. So for us, if we're thinking, if we spend a lot of time on layout of pages, and the page layout is part of our pedagogy, then this fixed layout format is important for us. The other format is a flowing format, and that's the format that you see on most e-readers. It's a format that if you want to, for example, change the font size to get a larger font size, this text will then reflow. You won't see as much text on the page. Another characteristic is it interactive or not? Okay, that's important for educational digital books. So can students take quizzes embedded in the book? And will the computer score those for them? And will it store the scores? And will it send those scores somewhere to an LMS so that instructors can look at them and use them for evaluation and assessment? All right, so once again, when we're thinking about these digital formats, these are the characteristics we're thinking about, because these are the characteristics that distinguish the digital format. So fixed or flowing, interactive or not, store student data, and can it send that data to an LMS?
Help.
Okay, help. I think we have two questions here.
I think the points you just made are very, very important, and they're a source of frustration in my last couple of editions, because isn't one of the other parts of the equation predicting what hardware your end user is using? Doesn't that affect what kind of, or how well the format that your publisher chooses to use shows up on that particular device? And can interactive sometimes mean something as simple as, I have the page looking like this, but there's a lot of visual elements on it, and with that tiny screen, you're not going to get the visual elements the way I want you to, so you need to be able to at least tap on it and make the picture bigger, make the caption of the picture bigger, those kinds of things.
Let me clarify. Of course, in each of these categories, there is a continuum of capability. So interactive could mean, in some instances, perhaps the student can take a little quiz, or in this case, it's just a little try it to sort of check if students understood this paragraph. So here's something that they do, and they may get a response from their device, but that response may not be stored, and it may not be sent to the instructor. And when we talk about media in a device, you know, what kind of media will it play? Will it play Flash? Will it play, you know, MOV files, illustrations, 3D, you know, what does it do? There's a continuum of stuff that it may or may not do. Yes?
I haven't yet figured out what LMS is.
Oh, sorry. It's a learning management system. So something like Blackboard or Desire to Learn, Moodle. All right. So there are six popular digital book platforms. All right, first one, EPUB. So this is the thing that you see on the Kindles. And there are three versions of EPUB, 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. Yeah. Now, EPUB 1 is the one that you actually typically see, which is basically text that flows on a page, okay? And you can have some little black and white diagrams, well, in it. EPUB 3 is the one that you read about. Everybody talks about EPUB 3. Why? Because EPUB 3 is is a combination of HTML5, okay, and CSS3. CSS is cascading style sheets, and that's the thing that kind of controls how the HTML document is displayed on the screen. Okay, now, not all that important, but so as I said, this is EPUB is available on Kindles, Androids, iOS, OS X, the Nook, the Kobo, Windows. So EPUB in some version or other, you can get a reader, for example, for your laptop computer, or you can use it on a standalone device like a Kindle. So this looks like, oh, great. It can be used everywhere, okay? But a problem. So this EPUB 3, which has digital rights management, meaning, you know, it's harder to copy and pirate and distribute this stuff, which is good for us, right? We don't want our books out in the wild. It supports images. It supports tables, sound, interactivity, and video. It is a flowing format, though, so you're under most circumstances, but you can also do fixed format in EPUB 3. But, there's a big but, okay? Although EPUB is supported on all these devices, EPUB 3 readers are scarce and they don't work very well. So you create something in EPUB 3, you're intending to have all this bells and whistles on it, and yeah, it works on your Android device, but oh, oops, and iOS, doesn't work. So this, the promise of EPUB 3 is so far has been a lot of hype. Yeah, got another question.
Are textbook publishers actually using these formats, or are they focused on proprietary formats? Mm.
Okay, yeah. They are not, well, some of them are and some of them aren't. Pearson, for example, has some stuff that they have in EPUB and some stuff that they have in EPUB 3. Cengage, though, is not using the EPUB format at all. Cengage has a proprietary platform, the Cengage Brain, which is basically HTML and JavaScript, which I'm going to get to a little later.
So isn't that part of what's making adoption so slow, is that there isn't a common platform that can service all of the content from all the publishers.
That is.
Unlike the dominance of the Kindle in trade publishing.
Right, you're right. So there is not. And the publishers' platforms, the publishers' proprietary platforms, don't play well together. You're using one platform, you're using Cengage platform, you're using the Pearson platform, your students are using both. And up until last year, there was a lot of problem getting the results back to the learning management systems that the instructors had. Now there's some kludgy thing that sort of helps that, but it's not good. So the technology is very, what I would say, rough. We are still in the developmental stages in a lot of the stuff. Yeah.
Well, so I'm wondering what statistics are out there about the corollary here, that if I'm a student and I purchase access to an ebook and then I find that on my device the damn thing doesn't work the way the professor says it's supposed to work, I want my money back. I wonder, do we know how many people are saying, I want my money back?
I don't know. Another format that we're all familiar with is PDF. PDF. PDF, there are several versions of PDF, just like there are versions of EPUB. The most widely used version of PDFs, though, support tables and images, but not interactivity. There is a version that does support interactivity and media like video, but that's not commonly used. Why? Because it's expensive to license the readers and the technology from Adobe. This PDF is a fixed format. We have HTML. HTML is another format for ebooks, but plain HTML basically supports images, tables, sound, and video. It's an open standard. but there's no digital rights management on it. So difficult, unless you have it behind a firewall where students have to log in to get to it, you're not going to have any chance of protecting your content. And even then, behind the firewall, it's fairly easy to pull that content elsewhere. So HTML has been not such a great solution by itself. Okay. Now, also, we have iBooks, which is Apple's offering in the market. You've probably heard about the iBooks initiative that started about 3 years ago. iBooks, the format is really a proprietary version of EPUB 3, but it has specialized digital rights management that allows Apple to control the format. So this format, which is a nice format, it has a lot of bells and whistles. It's perfectly acceptable for educational uses, but it's pretty much controlled by Apple and only works on Apple platforms. Kindle version. There's a Kindle format which supports images. It supports tables, sounds, does support some interactivity and video. It's flowing text, okay, but it hasn't taken off for some reason. I'm not sure why, in the textbook market. And then finally what we have is we have a combination of HTML and JavaScript. And this appears to us as just kind of a website, okay, but the JavaScript gives the HTML a lot more interactivity and allows the developers of a website that has educational content on it with HTML to have interactive questions, testing, and then to computer score those test questions, and then to send that information back to a learning management system. Right now, this is probably the best solution that we have for educational materials, this combination of HTML and JavaScript.
One thing that they might not be aware of, because when people hear HTML or HTML JavaScript, they're assuming that it's going to be online. But actually, HTML JavaScript can also run locally. So there's the other distinction is it a local content or browser-based content? HTML and HTML JavaScript often being done as local stuff, particularly when you get to applications on iOS or on Android devices. Usually what you're doing there is you make a web view like a captive browser. That's displaying HTML content, but it looks to the user like an application. So a lot of things that don't look like HTML and aren't in a browser are actually HTML, is I guess what that is.
Okay. All right. So that's enough of the tech talk. So do you have any more questions about the technical stuff before your eyes glaze over? I promised to talk about some technical things, so I wanted to present that information. But I want to go beyond that, and I want to get back into the market focus, because this is what really concerns us, I think, as textbook authors. There's a guy named Michael Porter, and he came up many years ago with this thing called the Five Forces Model, which helps you analyze industries that are in change, that are in flux, okay? And the Five Forces Model has these five rings to it. And the centralized ring is industry rivalries. And in the traditional textbook market, we, you know, kind of know about these industry rivalries, Cengage, Pearson, Wiley, okay? But there are also some other things that we have to be concerned about in markets. And one is a threat of substitute products or services. Another one is a threat of new entrants. We also have the bargaining power of buyers. Those are our students. And we have the bargaining power of suppliers, which actually I think is of small relevance for our situation. But these other four rings are quite important, so I want to talk about those a little bit. Threat of new entrants. Okay. We've seen several new entrants, actually a lot of new entrants into this market. Remember, this is a $5 billion business. It's like, you know, the economy of a small country. And so people are looking at any way to monetize that market. So some of these, to write this down so I can remember what each of these are. Okay, OpenStax. OpenStax is a project that was funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They gave them many millions of dollars. It's run by Rice University in Texas, and they have produced so far about a dozen open source textbooks that are, they have a CC BY license, which means that you can, anybody can use that and simply give credit to the OpenStax initiative that they have used it. So instructors can use the material and modify it to their liking. Other publishers could use that material. Anybody online could use that material in just about any way they want. Then there is, for example, Boundless. Okay, Boundless. I copied this from their blurb. Boundless provides low-cost alternatives to standard college textbooks. While the list price of an assigned textbook might be $175, Boundless customers can buy an online textbook covering the same subject material for $20. The search feature provided by Boundless allows students to find similar material to the material in the required text. So basically what's going on is they're creating books, and in fact they have created some books that looked very, very much like the original books produced by Cengage and Pearson. In fact, weren't they sued by... Yeah, because their books were too much like it. So now their books are a little more generic, but you have a search function so that you can find, you know, if you need to find something about molecular weights in your chemistry book, well, here you go, search for it, you find the molecular weights unit, and you're off and running. At least that's how they advertise it. We all know about flat world knowledge. Currently, their model is to offer... students textbooks that they can read online for $24. They can get a study pass for $39, which means that you can not only read it online using a browser, but you can download it to various devices such as a tablet computer. So you can use it on any device that you have. And they will also provide students with a print version, a black and white print version, for $59. That's Flat World. There's another outfit called Book Boon, which is, I think, from Denmark. And Book Boon, which is not listed on there, has about 1,000 free textbooks. And those textbooks, what's their economic model? Advertising. So students get to see ads. I fear that the textbook market is going to have to head in that direction. And maybe I'll have retired by the time that happens. So, you know, how successful are these competitors, these new entrants into the textbook market? Well, okay, so far OpenStax has had about 170,000 downloads of its books. And this would be in the last 2 years. Flat World claims to have about 300,000 downloads. Book Boon, 42 million, and Boundless, about 1 million books. Now, think about that. That's a lot of books pulled out from the Cengage, Pearson, Macmillan, Houghton Mifflin market. Question. Want me to back up?
Why does Book Boon have so many more than the others? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't. That's a good question, though. That is a lot more. Yeah, another question in the back.
When you say the books are taken from Cengage and Wiley and so forth, taken without paying for them?
No, no. What I'm saying is that these, all of these downloads are books that otherwise would have been sold through Cengage and Pearson and the main book publishers. And, you know, those are books that we as authors are not, you know, we're not selling them through our traditional publishers. They're being sold through other publishers. So we're not getting a piece of that action.
We don't get any royalties.
Well, these are not, these are books that are not our, these are not ours. These are books that other people are writing. A lot of times they're old books that are hauled out of, you know, the backlists of publishers. But no, I mean, we're not, yeah. What?
Those are often open source books.
Yeah, a lot of, yes, and a lot of these are open source books, right? So, you know, somebody has authored them somewhere. But, you know, we've talked about in other sessions the sustainability of a model for producing books. And I think one of the things that goes on, for example, with OpenStax is that they had this initial batch of seed money that they spent to get the books done. But if they don't have enough money coming in from sales of their books, they're not going to be able to pay the authors anything for a next edition. So you end up with one edition of these books. And in the meantime, you know, this edition is taking away sales from publishers who have a sustainable publishing model. So this is a this is definitely a disruptive influence, I think, in the market that traditional publishers are trying to deal with and not always very successfully. You know, just to give you an idea of, you know, open resource use, people who are students who are using these open resources like OpenStax, out of 10 students, about three did not, you know, typically three did not use them. Three experimented with them. Three use them on occasion, and only one out of 10 students looks for those open source resources and tries to use them all the time. Now, I think we can expect that those, that number may grow, the number that use them all the time may grow. So, those were the new entrants in the market, and the new entrants, the publishers who are trying to provide students with really low cost or free textbooks, seems to be cutting into some of the revenues of the mainstream publishers. All right, the second ring that we need to consider is the bargaining power of the buyers, the students. Okay, so the students get information like this. The price of textbooks from 1984 to 2014 has increased 800%. Well, I say really because I don't think that's really true. I looked at the BLS actual statistics, and it seemed like the increase was 285%, not 800%. But anyway, it is increasing. And, of course, then they compare. They say, well, textbooks have increased 800%, and healthcare's only increased 575%. And the consumer price index has only gone up 250%. So what's the deal with these textbooks? We're paying way too much for them. That's what they think. Then they see this other information, okay? How much profit does McGraw-Hill make annually? 25% profit margins? Yikes. Wiley, 15%. Pearson, 10%. This is more realistic, I think. Okay. And then they see that an average student pays $1,200 a year for textbooks. That's a lot for many students, a lot. So what happens? 20% of students rent textbooks. 56% of students want to rent textbooks. They think that's a good idea. And when we look at the used book sales, the ratio of new to used books is about 1.7 to 1. So it's almost almost twice as many new books as used books, which is surprising. Here are some more statistics from the Pub Tracker. This is fascinating. Keep pressing that button, sorry. Okay. Rental units. This is rental, textbook rentals. What's going on with them? Okay, in academic year 2011, there are about 1.5 million new rental textbooks that were purchased or rented by students. Okay, the next year, that doubled. And the next year, it went up about 33%. So there's been a remarkable increase. Used rental units. This is like the worst nightmare because they're not only used books, but now they're renting the used books. And we get zero from this. I mean, absolutely nothing. So started out 1.6 million, 4 million, 7 million. The increase has been like 72%. It's crazy. And we're looking at the sales amount, you know, the income, the net from this thing. It's just gone through the roof. Now, so what happens when a student, you know, students, oh, spending too much on textbooks, what to do? So they go to the publisher's site. They start out publisher's site, and they see that the price of this book is $279.95. They blanch. They go white. They can get the book from Cengage Brain for $223. So they're getting a little deal. Cengage likes to put a list price, and then they like to give the students a little bit of a deal. They can rent the book from Cengage for $44. That's not too bad. And they can get an e-book. Here we're back to the digital book thing. They can get the e-book for $55.49. But the student says, they're smart. They say, well, you know, this is the publisher. What the heck? That publisher is making a lot of money, a lot of margin, so their books must not be priced very well. So let me see what I can get. So they go online to a place like Slug Books, and here's what they see. Okay, here's the list price. From Amazon, you can buy this book for $109, new. From Abe Books, you can get it for $114. They don't have such a good deal with Cengage. From eBay, you can get one for $98.96. It may not be the most recent edition. You'll have to be very careful as a student to see which edition you get. You can rent the book from Chegg for $33.99. Less than you can rent it from Cengage. From Book Renter, you can get it for $29. From Amazon, you can get it for $33. And from Valor Books, you can get it for $19.80. I would be suspicious about that last one if I was a student, but you check it out. Okay. So now, for us as authors,
I have a couple questions.
I
have a contract with Cengage, and I don't remember rentals being discussed in my agreement, and so I was wondering how they handle that with the authors. And then also, if you look at the rental price, it's about 1/7 of the hardcover retail price. I can't imagine they're ever going to be able to rent that 7 times to students to make up the difference. So, anyway.
You have identified the very troubling aspect of this new, brave new world, okay, of multiple distribution channels, all right? Most of our contracts do not have rentals specified in them, and so what's happening is the publisher is just assuming that they have the right to rent those books, and they're treating that as net sales, okay? So, well, what is your royalty rate for net sales for a standalone book? Okay, but no, because And before I leave the slide, let me just say, it's worth your while to go on something like Slug Books or 20 Million Minds, put in your textbook, and see what it's being sold for and which outlets are selling it.
The other thing to keep in mind is that the rentals aren't necessarily coming from Cengage, because nothing prevents someone from buying books wholesale from Cengage, doing a rental business. Then they don't have to rent it seven times. They just have to rent it four times. The rest is gravy. So that may have nothing to do with Cengage. It's just the wholesale purchase of books at a discounted price.
All right, so now, this is really important. Here's what's going on. In 2010, about 20% of students got books from Amazon. Now, in 2013, about 40% of students get books from Amazon, and this is growing. And look at what this says, retail sources, retail sources. Okay, now you look in your contract, and you see if you have a clause like this. 8%, which is half the royalty rate, or whatever your royalty rate is, divided in half, half of your royalty rate of net sales of the textbook sold in bulk quantity at special discounts with special covers or other special sales incentives to professional groups, industry. That doesn't sound too bad. Retailers or wholesalers. So whenever your publisher is selling to Amazon, or to Chegg, or to any one of these retail non-college bookstore outlets, you're only getting half your royalty rate. And that may not sound so bad. Oh, you know, I'm a $100 book. My royalty is 15%. I usually get $15. So when they sell to Amazon, I'm only going to get $8.750. But, yeah. They're selling those books to Amazon for $50. And so it's not that you're getting half of your usual royalty amount, but you're getting half the rate on half the price. So you're getting $3 on the books that are sold through Amazon. Yes?
I'm with Sage Publications. Okay. I'd be very surprised if any publishers are treating Amazon as a special sale. I mean, clarify it. Certainly Sage does not.
Well, that's good if you're a Sage publisher, but if you are a Cengage author, everything that does not go through a college bookstore or Cengage site itself is counted as retail sales, and my royalty statements will prove that. Okay. Plus, I just talked to my editor, and I said, I want you to clarify this for me, and she did. So I'm unhappy about that, and I think we as authors need to really look at this in our contracts. This is going to be devastating for us, because when we think about how much of the sales are not going through the publisher and not going through bookstores, and how much of sales are now going through these other channels, our royalties are going to go through the floor if we don't get this fixed. Now, I don't know how to fix it, because when you talk to the publishers, they say, this is the way we've done it in the past. Okay. All right. So, last thing here.
Yeah, I'm skeptical, but
we've run into this directly with Pearson, where we can't get them to track pallets of books that end up at these discount places, or where the book shows up on a website before it even appeared in the warehouse in the U.S. It really is happening, but we can't get them to track it. Yeah. But maybe not Sage.
Okay.
No.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I want to continue. Okay.
We got about 10.
All right. Yeah, because there's another thing that's quite important here, though. I mean, you know, the textbook market is being disrupted by pricing, by publisher practices, by these new entrants. Okay, but there's another thing. We also have to think about the threat of substitute products or services. And let me just say, you know, I'm going to use this old example, okay? When cars came on the market and buggies, you know, started to kind of go away, there were still people who made buggy whips, right? And in fact, like the early, some of the early cars, maybe they were Model A's, had a little buggy whip holder on them. And, you know, what would you do with that? But anyways, all right. So here's the thing. Here's a guy, David Feingold from Rutgers. What does he say? MOOC is the new textbook. And although I don't agree with that statement, I think there is something for us to think about there, because there is a movement away from books to educational materials, which is a whole nother thing. This is a substitute service, and this is a threat of a substitute service. Now, even though this shows that not very many students have actually taken MOOCs, and in fact, a lot of students don't even know what the heck they are. Even if you, and not just say MOOCs, but say an online course with, you know, a whole bunch of students, okay? You don't know what that is. But right now, 7 out of 10 students don't even buy all the textbooks that are recommended or are required by their instructors. And we see Khan Academy, for example, in the past year, had a whole bunch of videos. A lot of students accessed them. I mean, they've got over 5,000 instructional videos and 100,000 practice problems that students can take. The number of instructors who do not require textbooks is increasing. They're finding materials elsewhere. Here's an interesting graph. What percent of students enrolled actually buy the required textbook? All right, it varies by discipline, but you can see, all right, how many buy new books in English? 40% of the students buy a new book, 20% buy a used book, a few buy, you know, rental books, but only 70% of the students are buying the required books. In economics, it's worse. I don't know how they pass these courses. 45% of the students are buying the book. And in math, the same thing. Psychology is not much better. Our business is books, at least right now it is. And if the students aren't buying books and instructors aren't requiring books, we're in trouble. Okay, so there are technology-enhanced learning systems. Now, I'm not talking about digital books anymore. I'm talking about learning systems that students may be using. Not now. I think this is sort of in the future. It may be coming. This may be the next thing that we have as a challenge as authors. So these online learning systems have elements like there's content in them, okay? There is content, and that's maybe our part. But there's also a lot of media content, instructor videos. Okay, there's communication, student to instructors and students to students. There's some kind of interactive element in this, like note-taking, computer-scored assessment, projects, assignments, links to ancillaries. There's some kind of management component, like a learning management system, where there'll be a syllabus, a calendar, a student roster perhaps, test banks. And there are going to be analytics so that instructors can track what students are doing and so students can track what they are doing also. All right? But I think it's important to note, you can say, yeah, but all these things are there. We, you know, we already have all that stuff there. But I think the difference is that this content is going to be integrated into the rest of this stuff. So you're not going to have a book and other components. You're going to have one learning management kind of thing, environment, and we're going to be supplying maybe some of the content for that entire system. That will give it, there'll be, the model will be very different because it's not, there's not going to be a book that can be sold. There'll be instead maybe by the, we'll get paid by the word or by the word that people use. You know, we'll be paid by bits. I don't know. It's a brave new world out there. But in the meantime, okay, I'm going to wrap this up. In the meantime, I think that what we need to do is we need to start promoting what we do. What are the advantages of textbooks? Why are they worth paying for? And I'm talking about print or digital books. Doesn't matter. They're the same thing, just a different format. But what is it about these things that is important pedagogically for students and for instructors? So I would suggest the following. The textbook is kind of a de facto contract between instructors and students, right? It encompasses the main body of knowledge that students are expected to learn. And, of course, students always want to know, is it on the test? This tells them it's on the test if it's in the book. Textbooks provide an organized framework for learning, unlike a collection of random articles accessed from the web. It really helps the students nail down those progressions and create that cognitive map. Textbooks save you time as the instructor and as the student. Okay, the authors gathered the material for you, so you don't have to wade through a bunch of Google results. That applies both to students and to instructors. Textbooks give you the straight story. Okay, there's a lot of information on the internet, but we know that a lot of that information is misleading, incomplete, biased, or totally false. Textbooks can help students improve their grades. They contain exercises, activities, quizzes. 78% of students believe, and the evidence supports it, that students get lower grades if they do not own their own copy of the required text. So if they're trying to read it in the library, borrow it from a friend, their grades are not going to be as good as if they actually had a textbook. Textbooks are actually a bargain. Each hour a student spends sitting in class costs about $42 at today's tuition rates. Each hour spent with a textbook, if you've used the traditional model of, you know, hours in class to hours with a textbook, costs about $2.50. So, we, as textbook authors, I think, need to make a concerted effort to promote the product of our labor and counter some of the arguments about how textbooks are too expensive for students. Our textbooks have value, and we need to promote them.